Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, I'm Larry Mueller, and really pleased to have back Mark Dwyer. Mark is Director of Horticulture at the Rotary Gardens. The official name is the Rotary Botanical Gardens in Janesville. He has degrees in landscape architecture and urban forestry, and we're going to talk with him about the gardens, of course, about gardening, and a little on how to get children interested in gardening. What's the benefit of it, and certainly, how do you go about doing it and do a good job of it? And, of course, we'll be answering your gardening questions as well. I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. And tweet us at L Mueller Show. And Mark Dwyer, welcome back.
Thanks, Larry. Great to be here.
And how are the gardens looking in Janesville?
Nice and green. Very, very lush with the recent rains. So things are springing alive literally here.
Tell our listener, I know a lot of people are familiar with the Rotary Gardens, but talk a bit about it.
Sure. Well, the gardens, again, down in Janesville, Wisconsin, we were founded 27 years ago. It's a 20-acre botanic garden on the site of an old sand and gravel pit. Yeah. And we're on City of Janesville land. We're a nonprofit, and our mission is education. So for visitors that have not yet come to the gardens, we have a lot of thematic spaces, like an English cottage garden, a French formal garden, a prairie, Japanese garden. So a lot of different styles that encompass over 4,000 types of plants.
And really very conveniently located right off the interstate.
Right off of I-90. So it is very convenient, and it's easy to find.
Well, we'll talk some more about the garden as we move along. But what about, I know you guys have quite an educational mission, as you just said. And I think gardening for children can be such a great hobby and learning experience. What are some good ways to get children interested and started in gardening?
Well, I feel they're never too young to get them to participate in what we're doing in our own yards and in landscapes, to have them enjoy seeing the process of growing plants. And at the gardens, many of our education and our outreach programs target different grade levels with different specific themes. But again, at home, the connection with children and plants can be made very simply by giving them their own little container garden and letting them have their own tomato plant to nurture and grow from a little seedling all the way to picking the produce and enjoying it. And that connection not only can create a gardener for life, but our future environmental stewards, that connection to the outdoors is something that I think is becoming lost on our kids. And, you know, I'll hop off the soapbox here, but, you know, a lot of them are in the basements playing video games when we should have them outside and involved.
You mentioned tomatoes. What other plants would you recommend?
Well, you know, herbs, I think, are a great connection. The sensory experience. And if the early gardeners, these youngsters, can grow something that will provide food or flavor or scent or even something, they could create their own butterfly garden. What's interesting this year at the gardens, we have a hummingbird haven theme. So in our children's garden, the theme is all plants that will attract hummingbirds. And the hope is children of all ages, of course, will go through and learn about the types of plants that will attract these hummingbirds. What a great way to, again, connect kids to not only gardening, but wildlife.
Are there any concerns about, you know, safety or otherwise that we should be aware of?
Well, you know, food allergies are something to consider, certainly if you're growing food, but also, you know, there are toxic and poisonous plants. So it's important to research, you know, again, that angle, but there's so many safe opportunities for children. So certainly want to be safe, and, you know, it's a personal decision on the use of chemicals and pesticides in our yards, but there's implications to doing that as it relates to our safety as well. So I think the parents certainly should be involved, and it's great. We have volunteers, grandparents and parents bringing children as young as 18 months to 2 years old, and they're jumping right in. And for many, it's a new experience, and I look at these little kids and think, you know, these will be our volunteers in, you know, in 15 years and 20 years. But they love it.
Well, what about work and the amount? You know, I think there are things that we could do that we might do that would discourage them or, you know, turn them away from gardening. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Oh, absolutely. I think if your intent, for instance, this weekend is to try to engage the younger demographic in gardening, don't just give them a dandelion digger and say, here you go, because that's part of gardening, certainly. But I think the joy, the connection in observing and growing these living plants is more important. So there has to be an angle where I think the child's not only participating, but there's a sense of stewardship or ownership with what they're doing. It's not just helping out, which certainly can be part of it, but give them some responsibility and guide them through that process. And that helps in so many other ways in their lives as well.
You guys have a plant sale coming up. You mentioned plants pretty soon, do you not?
We do. Mother's Day weekend, yes.
Oh, perfect time.
It is.
Well, tell us about it.
Absolutely. Well, it's a fundraiser for the gardens. It's important to mention that, but we always encourage people to patronize our local garden centers. Absolutely. We only have two sales a year, but our spring sale, our intent, our niche, so to speak, is heirloom vegetables, herbs, a lot of edibles. We'll also have perennials and shrubs, and this will be both Saturday and Sunday of Mother's Day, 9 to 4. Everything's on our website, including plant lists for the veggies.
Okay.
And for us, it's a great way to share our love of gardening, but for people to pick up some affordable plants and get going right away.
We have callers online. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234. Oh, by the way, Johanna posted a photo on Facebook of her youngsters and herself outside gardening. She says her kids are interested in gardening because they've always participated. They have a garden at their school, and it provides really endless learning opportunities, and she's certainly right about that.
Absolutely.
Well, let's turn to Kathy in Milwaukee next. Kathy, hi. Thanks for calling.
Well, thank you for taking my call. And I have to say that, first of all, I'm so glad to listen to the show, because later this afternoon I'm going over to babysit for my great niece and nephew, and I get to look at their untouched yard with them and talk about what fun we're going to have in doing planting soon. So thank you for...
Ah, perfect.
Yeah. But on the other hand, for my own yard, I live in Milwaukee. I'm near the lake. And, of course, as you know, it's been very cold here, generally speaking. And I have a few new small trees that are going to be planted and some shrubs. And I had understood that they'd be delivered at the end of May, and I was good with that. But now I'm told they want to bring them on May 7th. And I'm wondering about if that's too early to plant because everything is so cold, the ground is so cold.
The short answer, Kathy, is it's not too early to plant. In fact, despite the soil temperatures being a little cold, that's would be a negative if you were planting vegetables and annuals and tropicals if you know, we still have the chance of frost. But likely, the trees and shrubs you've ordered were locally grown, are probably still leafing out and adjusting to the same air temperatures. But we've been planting trees and shrubs at the gardens here for a couple weeks now. So, again, it's certainly not too early for woody plants.
Great. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. So what are you guys planning this year? Are you planning some new things?
You know, we're kind of running out of space on our 20 acres. We're replacing some trees. We have a beaver that's been taken down 6 trees now along our shoreline, and cherry trees and birch trees and all the soft-wooded trees. So we're trying to find some replacements. But, you know, we're going to be real heavy on perennials and seasonal plants this year, like we usually do.
We have Lisa on Facebook wondered about grass and weeds from growing around plants, like strawberry plants and things like that. What do you do to control that?
Well, you know, the fact that it's an edible plant, strawberries, I'm wary of any sort of chemical use.
Because yep.
Someone might recommend, y'all use a pre-emergent to keep the weeds away. I worry immensely about that. So the short answer is I recommend manual removal. And if the strawberries are so embedded with grasses and weeds, you can actually, on a cloudy day, even now, lift them and rinse all the soil off, separate the weeds, literally take the strawberries up with all the weeds, separate the weeds, and replant the strawberries. That doesn't affect that you may still have some weed seeds in the soil, but again, it's a manual process. I don't advocate any chemical use.
Yeah, that makes sense. You can. There's no reason why you can't dig them up and replant them.
Right. Perfect time.
Absolutely. The specialty gardens that you folks have at Rotary Gardens, go through those for me.
Sure. Well, you know, 40% of the gardens is different each year. Now, we have 26 thematic gardens, and I alluded to our Japanese garden, our prairie. But each year we have new garden spaces. This year, an heirloom garden, heirloom varieties of veggies, herbs, and other plants. The Hummingbird Haven I alluded to. We're going to have an All-America Selection Garden, which will be award-winning plants, really a very colorful space. Caladium collection, which are subtropical plants with very colorful foliage. And again, we rotate color schemes throughout the gardens as well, and we'll install about 150,000 annuals. The super neat collection this year, it's a giant aquarium, and I kid you not, it's actually a structure with blue plastic sides. It's human size, not filled with water. It's an imaginative space where kids will enter, and they'll feel like they're underwater. So there'll be live plants and seashells.
Oh, man.
It's going to be really sharp.
When is that going to be in effect?
Well, we're still building it, but by June 1, it'll be ready to roll. And it's built after the book Life in the Coral Reef. So its educational component is teaching about aquatic plants, water quality. It's going to be neat.
That sounds really, really cool. Mm-hmm. Talking today on this edition of Garden Talk with Mark Dwyer, Director of Horticulture at the Rotary Botanical Gardens in Janesville, degrees in landscape architecture, urban forestry, and wonderful to have him with us. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our on-air producer here for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Next week on Garden Talk, we'll be visiting with a couple of gardening experts from the University of Wisconsin-Madison Arboretum. So I hope you can join us for that. Looking forward to it. Right now, though, having a lot of fun talking with Mark Dwyer, Director of Horticulture at the Rotary Botanical Gardens in Janesville. Wonderful to have him along. And again, you can join us at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. We'll get you on pretty quickly. 1-800-642-1234. Email at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Ellie on Facebook posted that she wants to grow heather and hen and chicks for her daughter's wedding. Do you have tips for growing those?
Well, I hate to be a downer to start out with, but the heaths and heathers are extremely difficult to grow. They're marginally hardy even in the southern portion of the state and need very acidic, well-drained soils. We've dabbled with heathers. They're very difficult to grow. If the interest is in heathers, talk to a local florist and have them order some in or even a garden center. I wouldn't attempt to try to grow them from seed or, again, they're very challenging, particularly in our soils. Hen and chicks are extremely easy to grow. They're actually very affordable as well. My concern would be what size she might like, because semper vivums, these hen and chicks, expand, their radius expands over the years. So if the intent is getting a sizable plant by a summer wedding this year, I would consider...
Not going to happen.
So purchase them as larger plants. And many of the box stores and, of course, your local garden centers carry hen and chicks, and very affordable. So, keep an eye out for them.
Yeah, that's probably the way to go. Or maybe even talk in advance with somebody from your garden center about making sure that they're available when you need them.
Absolutely.
Have them on order. Mm-hmm. James and Kimberly up next. Hi, James.
Hi, how's it going?
Great, appreciate the call.
Thanks for having me on the show. Sure. I'm calling to ask your expert there. I have quite a large Japanese dappled willow, and over the last couple of years, it's slowly, half of it is, I have to keep cutting back because it just keeps browning out. Now, I know I have a little bit of that each throughout the year, little bits of it die, but just like whole parts of it have browned out and just went dead. And I'm wondering, I'm thinking I'm losing the whole thing. So I'm wondering if your expert has some kind of idea of like what's going on with it, how I could fix that.
Well, great question. The dappled willow, we have a lot of them at Rotary Gardens, and something we do with ours first and foremost is As I sit here, they've all been cut back this previous fall to 6 inches. We okay. butcher them back because what we get is brand new growth, and you've observed your willow with its newest growth having that nice kind of frosty whitish
pink
look.
Yeah, it almost gets like it looks like it has flowers, but that's because the leaves are turning the like a more of a pinkish color.
Right.
Before they go green. Right.
Right, and that best color is on the newest growth. Now the browning could be a fungal problem. We see some browning on ours, but what we find is by rejuvenating the shrub severely, and all willows, by the way, want to continue to grow. So okay. I would advocate a severe cutback, even cutting the right. entire thing back. And
yeah, I've never really cut it all the way back. It's just like I trimmed it somewhat, but you're saying cut it way back down to like 6?
Oh, yeah, butcher it to just nubs and stubs, and I guarantee it'll explode with, and do it very soon, and it'll explode with brand new growth.
My wife about that.
Yeah.
Yes. It should right. it should recover.
All right, that sounds good. I was thinking I was going to lose the whole thing, but
well,
yeah.
Give that a shot. You're going to I think you're going to be pleasantly surprised, James. Appreciate the call. Julie and Eau Claire up next. Hi, Julie.
Hello. Here's my question. I've got a huge compost pile. It's great compost from my cattle's manure that I scooped together in a great big pile, but I noticed that last year the weeds were growing out of it just crazy. What's the best way? Should I cover that? I thought the rain would maybe be good for it, and I did spray one pile with Roundup. What will that hurt? I use the compost mostly for flowers.
Okay.
Right. Well, do you turn your compost pile?
Oh, yes. It's already great compost.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, then, the question becomes if the weed seeds with the heat of your compost pile, if the weed seeds haven't died and are germinating, or it's weed seeds that have come in via air or some other method.
Yeah, it's on top. It's on top of the pile. It was
right, right. I wouldn't advocate putting plastic over it because what you'll do is it'll get extremely hot, but you'll kill a lot of the good microbes that are in that compost.
Okay.
So, and I'd avoid any more Roundup simply because I'm not convinced that there's not implications for that if you use it immediately. After doing that, what I'd recommend is maybe combing off that top layer and separating it, and then getting into the interior portion of that compost pile where it's the hottest. Use that first, and then keep rotating the pile. We have a compost pile the size of a Greyhound bus at Rotary Gardens, and we have weeds all over it. And we do the exact same thing. We're taking from the inside of the pile.
Oh, I never thought of that because this is a big pile that I all scooped together from the cattle's manure and just made mm-hmm. a big, and then put a bale ring around it to hold
right.
it together. But the whole top was just covered with awful weeds last year. So
right, right. No, go to the inside of the pile, and that type of manure is excellent for the garden as long as it's aged, and you shouldn't have any problems. Not to say it'll be weed free, but it'll have a lot less weeds.
Okay, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. We'll get you on pretty quickly. Let's turn to Facebook for a minute because we've got an interesting photo on Facebook, Mark. And Jordan Young is wondering, what are we looking at? What's that pretty flower?
Yeah, that's looks like a trout lily to me and erythronium. And
yeah.
Trout lily, that sort of liver-spotted leaf is very indicative of it. It's a shade-tolerant ephemeral. It comes up very early. In fact, if that's a recent picture, I would not be surprised if that were blooming now. So, trout lily.
Yeah, it's really, really pretty and worth a look. Go to our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show and click on the posts over on the left side, and you'll see that photo of it. It really is quite attractive. We have more openings for you at 1-800-642-1234. What are some of the new flowers this year? Do you have some? You're trying some new award winners this year, and what are you kind of looking forward to seeing?
Well, we do a lot of trialing, so we're featuring, unfortunately, some of the plants won't be out for the consumer till next year. So we trial for about a dozen organizations, so it's a lot of fun things to see. Mm. But we don't do row trials. We incorporate them throughout our various beds and such. That All-America Selection Garden will be dynamite with different award-winning plants, including some vegetables. But we're going to go heavy again on shade-tolerant perennials. We're huge fans of ferns. We love epimediums, also called barren warts, very shade-tolerant, tough-as-nails perennial. And getting into more hostas and pulmonarias, which are called lung warts. Mm-hmm. And you know, the topic of shade gardening, if your listeners have a shade garden, it's not so much a limitation. There's a lot of potential, depending on the setting itself. But there's some great plants that are extremely low maintenance that'll thrive in those situations.
I always get a lot of questions for that. Mm-hmm. People wondering what they can grow in these high shade situations. So it'll be great to visit the gardens and take a look at what you've got going in those circumstances.
Well, we have two areas that are of deep shade, so some great examples of those plants that'll do well.
Let's turn to Amy in Beaver Dam next. Amy, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thank you. I'm wondering, how long does cow manure have to sit around before I should feel good about using it? My friend Tom has cows, and I can have manure whenever I want it, but at this point, it would be fresh manure.
Yeah.
Great question, and there's a lot of debate on that, to be honest. And my personal opinion on it, because we, down in Janesville, we've had some donations, massive truckloads of cow manure come in. We have the space to accommodate having that pile sit for literally one calendar year. We try to age it for at least a year. In some instances, we received it in late fall of a year and used it by summer the next year, meaning 6 to 7 months. It's a hot pile. You'll see it, you know, it's steaming when it's delivered. It'll be steaming as part of your compost pile. It breaks down fairly quickly. My big concern is not using it fresh, but making sure there's enough heat generated to deal with weed seeds, to be honest. So as long as you possibly can let it age and dedicate the space to doing so.
And that has to be turned, and how do you work with it?
Well, with compost piles, technically, they should be turned, yes. Technically, they don't have to be, but it just takes a lot longer. So turning, we try to turn our massive pile at least twice every month. And we get in there with an end loader because it's that big. But, you know, mixing it up and maybe adding some other materials to this and creating a more diverse compost pile, so to speak. But, again, let it age.
I see. So I shouldn't just go get some and put it right into the soil as I'm planting my garden.
I would not. And some people will disagree and say if it's mixed in or rototilled in or somehow incorporated quickly, it's safe. My concern is, again, being extremely fresh, there's a lot of heat involved. It's just starting to break down, and also there is the possibility of weed seeds causing a problem.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Those weeds, you don't want that. Jackie in Mequon, hello.
Hi there. I have a problem with buckthorn, and it just doesn't want to quit. What do you suggest?
Yeah, the buckthorn, this problem is prevalent through a good portion of the central in eastern United States. This buckthorn has invaded our woodlands. It's a huge problem, dispersed by birds, and it's everywhere. Now, at Rotary Gardens, on our 20-acre site, we've had a 27-year battle with buckthorn, and I'll tell you the best way to get rid of it, and we've had 95% success with it, and it's going to involve a waiting game, because what I'm going to tell you is we wait until October, when a lot of other trees have dropped their leaves. The buckthorn maintains green leaves all the way through November, so it's very easy to identify. Mm-hmm. And at that point in time, there's a lot of movement of tissue fluids into the root system, getting ready for winter. So what we do with buckthorn of 4 to 5 inch diameter, even to little twigs, is we go out in mid-October on a fairly warm day. We cut it all the way to the ground, exposing a very fresh open wound, and then we take a full strength herbicide like a Roundup, I mean a concentrate or a Brush Be Gone or Stump Killer or something like that. And I'm not a big chemical person, to be honest, but we brush just on that open face, and it goes right into the plant, and we've rarely seen rejuvenation.
Will it take care of it within that year?
The next spring we don't see it reemerge. The danger with buckthorn is it's notoriously hard to dig out. It's a very hard wood.
We've tried even with the backhoe.
Yeah.
Like a chain around it.
I know. It's very difficult. But get a fresh cut in fall, get some chemical on it, and you'll start to win the battle.
Do you have any suggestion of what to put in place of that buckthorn? I'm in a constant battle with the neighbor. She keeps fighting me to get rid of it because she likes that a lot of birds hang out there, which my husband hates because they come and poop on his car,
right,
and he has a mess all the time. But her point was she likes that it kind of goes into a full screen for privacy effect.
Right, and I've heard this discussion in the past. I would recommend finding some native understory trees, things like service berries, witch hazels, more shade tolerant, something that'll take the same conditions. But be wary of, once you remove that buckthorn, be wary of a couple years of seedlings coming up. You know, I'm not saying wait on replanting, but the battle is not going to be won in 1 year.
Can those new seedlings just be pulled out, or do you suggest them too to have the same method, cut them flush and then put the herbicide on?
You could do either. The seedlings are easier to pull. You've got to get that root system and, you know, explain to your neighbor that, yes, the birds love buckthorn, but that's why there's, you know, 300 billion of them throughout the, you know, the United States. So,
right.
There are other replacements that have even better wildlife value. And talk to your local extension agent. There's many, many things that are adequate replacements.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. And Dana and Madison up next. Hi, Dana.
Hey, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have kind of a two-part question. I am starting a plot in my community garden. It's about 9 by 12. There is a fence on the north side of the plot, and it faces, so it's kind of longer. It comes out more north-south, but it gets full east-west sun as well. So it's pretty full sun. I am trying to start a bee garden. And so my first question is, what can I do at the beginning with this absolutely nothing in the plot to prepare the bed for a bee garden? And then the second would be, do you have any suggestions on what type of perennial plants to put in there?
Well, great question. You know, some ways to approach the soil. First and foremost, regardless of your preparations, have some weed issues to deal with prior to mm-hmm. installing some other plants. If the soil is lean, meaning not overly enriched or seems a little bit on the sandier side, you might consider some compost or organic amendments to help increase the tilth and structure of the soil. A lot of the types of plants you would plant there, though, for your bees may include natives that are quite adaptable to a wide range of soils. And,
okay.
You know, if your approach is primarily perennials, there's so many great plants, things like catmint, bee balm, many of the cone flowers. If you were to hop online and even just do a search on bee garden perennials, you would find so many wonderful plants. And obviously you want it to look beautiful as well, but it's important to keep in mind your approach to that space should not include any chemicals in the future and should include plants that are blooming literally from April all the way into early October, because our pollinators are active not just in summer, they're already active. So make sure your blooming window, your selection of plants is a segue of blooms and beauty, of course, for a good 6 months of the year.
Okay, and you had mentioned if I have sandy soil, try compost. I believe the soil is more on the clay side, I think it's just basically fill dirt that was put in there. Is there any suggestions on help making that a little bit more healthy?
Well, you might want to consider a soil test to see what you're up against, but clay soil, it limits some of your selections. It's still very easy to work with it. Compost would not hurt a clay soil situation either. The issue there, though, is moisture retention. Clay soil's holding additional moisture. Adding compost makes it more moisture retentive, and my concern would be a drainage. If your focus is on native plants, many of them prefer well-drained soil, so you may need to focus on native plants or perennials for bees that will take clay soils. And that is another internet search or a discussion with your extension agent. That palette of plants exists as well. So I think your approach is right on. It's just kind of knowing what you're up against with that current soil.
Great. Okay. Thank you guys so much.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. We have Norman in Wausau next with a question. Hi, Norman.
Good morning. I'd like to ask your guest what suggestions he has for plants that develop galls. I've got some apple grafts that have developed it, and I've got some on some plum transplants that I noticed it on. And I know that you can destroy the plants and not plant there again, but is there any other alternative?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I wish I had a good answer for you. You know, galls are caused by, there's different causal agents creating galls, and getting proper identification of what's going on would be the first start. So that's something, again, I take photos or a sample of some sort to share with an extension agent, because I'm just wary of offering advice over the phone on that without seeing it personally. But
These definitely are galls. There's no, and I thought it was agro something tumefaciens. Agrobacterium tumefaciens, that's the primary bacterium that causes it.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I apologize. I still don't have good advice on how to deal with that. And I wonder if you were to talk with someone with an orchard or with a larger fruit growing facility who's probably run into the same issue, what their approach might be.
Yeah, be worth it. Thank you, Norman. And good luck. Thanks so much for calling. Walter in La Crosse has something for us. Hi, Walter.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm working with a farmer who has patches of ramps growing in his woods.
Mm-hmm.
And we were wondering, can they be transplanted somewhere else so that we don't need to stomp through the woods when the season comes up?
Yes, actually, your window is perfect right now. April's a great month to do it. I wouldn't wait too much later, because if we could start warming up in May, then it becomes a little trickier. So establishment now is perfect on ideally on an overcast day where you have some rain in the forecast in the next 2 or 3 days, or you can provide additional water. But absolutely.
And transplanting them has to be, again, in a wooded area, or shade is enough?
No, actually, the shade would be enough. The trick is going to be trying to mimic a similar lighting condition. So if they're not going into another portion of the woodlands or a similar site, you'd want to replicate a similar lighting situation.
Okay, cool.
All right, thanks a lot for calling. And Carol in Shelton has a question. Hi, Carol.
Hi. I was wondering if it's advisable to put cream on onions when you plant them.
And what would be your intent for preen to take care of any emerging weeds?
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, I have mixed feelings on some of the pre-emergence, including preen, to be honest. And my concern is its effectiveness. We've used it at the gardens with some success. But again, it's another chemical being used around edibles. So that's a personal decision for you. If manual weed control is not an option, then we do start leaning on chemicals. But I'm wary about advising that combination of chemical use around edibles.
Yeah.
Well, does that chemical go into it?
I don't know that for sure, to be honest.
Yeah.
It's just one of those things I worry about. I don't know that for sure.
Yeah. So the other option is mulching. I guess you could mulch around them as well.
Yeah, mulching might help eliminate some of the weeds. Tough to say.
That's actually how I used. I have leaves, chopped up leaves, that make a nice mulch, and keep the weeds out for the most part. And then, of course, those leaves by the end of the season, they're nothing.
Mm-hmm.
The back end of the soil, and it's
right.
Kind of fun. Thanks, Carol, for calling. Jay and Two Rivers, your turn next. Hi, Jay. Thanks for calling.
Good morning. Every spring, I have to reseed part of our backyard with new grass seed because of winter and dog damage. And I planted seeds about a week and a half ago when it was in the 50s here. And since it's been only in the 40s, if the sun is out, the ground temperature can get into the 70s and 80s. But if it's cloudy and cold, it's stays at air temperature, and I believe grass seed needs to be, or the temperature should be like 55 or more. Now, is there any danger of planting grass too soon? I do keep it damp, and I've got dirt over the seed, so it's not exposed.
We're actually overseeding most of our lawns right now. Now, we're in the southern portion of the state, so I can't attest to some of the weather further north or elsewhere. Mm-hmm. But the only danger in throwing seed out too early, and I know if we get warm days in March, sometimes I see people mowing and overseeding, and that scares me because that's just way too early. But we're going to get some warm days, and that soil temperature is slowly warming. And even if we get another cold spell or two, a lot of that seed will lay dormant until it has the right conditions. One danger, is wildlife, birds, and insects carrying away the seed, and that happens. But again, we've already sped 500 pounds of grass seed over our lawn, so I think it's a perfect time right now.
Well, I arm myself with about 40 or 50 pounds of seed annually, because then I've got a spot repair throughout the growing season.
mm-hmm.
But
perfect.
So as long as it's not out there, say for a couple of months, it won't rot, because I am watering it when it dries out.
Right. No, you're okay for a couple of weeks, and your repeated spot application is the way to go. And we do the exact same thing. And sounds like you have an excellent plan already in place.
For those listeners that have problems with dog spots, we have found that if you really flood, that you've got to pay attention and be out there with the dog. But if you really flood the area immediately after with a lot of water, it spreads it out and it prevents the dead spot. But you've got to be paying close attention and get it right away. So that's a problem too. But
the other way to do it that Dr. Patricia McConnell always advocated was train your dog to go in one spot in the corner of the, some off to the side somewhere, and always go in that same spot. And then they're not spotted all over the place.
Well, I've heard of that. The reason I don't do it is because then that spot would probably die for sure and be smelly. And if we keep after the grass and keep it fresh, you don't even know that we've got a dog or two, because it doesn't smell at all in the grass due to the nutrients. Grows like crazy. I don't have to fertilize back there.
Okay.
So I spread the pain out a little bit. But thanks for your help.
All right. Thanks, Jay, for calling. Appreciate it. David in Oshkosh emailed to say he has a small grouping of a variety of prairie plants that have been affected with powdery mildew. The plot's has full sun exposure, but the soil has poor drainage. It's primarily clay. He is using a fabric weed barrier, not black plastic, and 1 to 2 inches of mulch. Should he remove both to reduce the water retention? If not, what do you suggest?
Well, the mildew issue, I'm assuming this is from last year. He probably observed a lot of mildew. And remember, it was just so darn wet and cool all the way into late June. So mildew was very prevalent throughout the state last year. Back to the situation, I'm not a big fan of the weed barrier with a mulch on top, because as that mulch breaks down, it's trapped. Yeah. And it doesn't break down into the soil. So to David's question, I would get that fabric out of there, but replace your chips. The clay thing, many of those plants will be fine in clay. And if they grew halfway decently last year, they'll do well this year. But get the fabric out, restore the mulch, maybe add some. Hope for a nice hot year, good air circulation. And I bet you'll see a lot less mildew, if not a huge reduction in the same problem.
Great information. Talking today with Mark Dwyer, Director of Horticulture at the Rotary Gardens of Janesville. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you along for this edition of Garden Talk, visiting with Mark Dwyer, Director of Horticulture at Rotary Botanical Gardens. You may have a garden question for him. I hope you'll join in. Call at 1-800-642-1234, email at talk@wpr.org, or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Chris in Schulzberg has a question. Let's go there, or a comment. Hi, Chris.
Hi. I was wondering about the lady who has the buckthorn. instead of using herbicide, what if she drilled some holes and put some mycelium in there, some mycelium plugs, and grew mushrooms and let the mushrooms break it down? How would that work?
Oh, right in the buckthorn plant itself, you're saying?
Yeah, after you've cut it down. You know, like as a way to get rid of stumps. Hmm. Let mushrooms break it down.
Well, I think the problem there would be the actual tree is not dead at that point.
Uh-huh.
And so what happens with a buckthorn, if you, let's say you were cut that and to do nothing to it, the next year you have about 7 to 15 little sprouts come up very vigorously. So my concern would be, you know, if you were to do that approach, and it sounds like a way to also grow mushrooms and take care of the providing decay for that, but you really have to have that stump entirely die. And I know that this suggestion of a chemical is a severe approach, but that has to be taken into the plant all the way through the roots to avoid any sort of that suckering. And that would have to be done prior to any approach with mushrooms.
Oh.
Well, I mean, you see trees that have mushrooms growing out of them that are, you know, not dead.
Yeah, I don't know that your suggestion has been tried. It very well may work, but based on our experience with how quick this and tough this buckthorn is, if the desire is to remove it, your mushrooms might be affecting that central stump, but you're still going to have a lot of suckering the next year to deal with.
Oh. Interesting.
Yeah, buckthorn are hard to get rid of. Well, it was just an idea.
All right. Thanks, Chris. Appreciate the call. We have, Mark posted on Facebook to ask if it's too late to start tomato seeds indoors. I would say it's pretty late.
It's on the late side of things. You know, ultimately, if you're growing, if you can give ample heat and get them outside, you can still do it.
Yeah.
You might be picking in September, but that's all right.
Judith in Wausau has a comment or question. Hi, Judith.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
And thank you for a great show.
Thanks.
I look forward to perhaps getting to the botanical gardens, Mr. Dwyer. Question for you. I have a rose bush, a rather large rose bush. I would say it's at least 8 years old, red roses. Last year, it bloomed early once, very profusely, and despite my best efforts, did not bloom again throughout the summer. I'm wondering if I should give it any special care this year.
Well, I tell you, what you probably have is a type of rose that is a single-time bloomer. And, for instance, in our rose collection, we have about 40 roses, old-fashioned roses, climbing roses, really...
It usually blooms 3 times a summer.
Oh, so you've observed it repeat blooming, but it's just not
always.
It. Oh,
I see. This is the only time last year that happened.
Yeah.
I was so disappointed.
I see.
Even my neighbors noticed, you know, because they walked by and went, what happened? And I said, I don't know.
Right.
They sort of get weaker as they get older, or am I failing to do something?
They can get weaker in time, and something we do with those same types of roses I mentioned is we do a rejuvenation where we remove the largest canes, the largest stems, and we'll typically do that in late winter, early spring,
mm-hmm.
And so it's the vigorous new growth that tends to be more prone to heavy flowering. So if the rose is still growing well, I wouldn't worry that you can't reclaim the reblooming characteristics, but what I recommend is, and it's not too late to do it. I know they're probably leafing out for you now already, but... Not yet. Okay.
Oh, it's too cold here.
Okay. Yeah, it's hard to know where everyone's from, but get out there and, you know, take some of those older canes out.
Okay.
And you'll get some new growth, but in essence, you're trying to create a juvenile rose bush that will be more than happy to continue to bloom for you. But that's the approach I would recommend.
Oh, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling, Judith. And Sandy in New Berlin, your turn. Hi, Sandy.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Mark. I'm calling on behalf of my neighbor who's at work today, and she is struggling with a whole batch of daylilies along her property line along the driveway, and she is having that redesigned this year, and she needs to get those out. And she tried digging, and that was quite the effort that was required for that, and there's a lot of them. So she asked me to call in and see if there's any help in terms of suggestions.
Now,
are these
the orange ones that we commonly?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Yes. The classics, the ones you see along the roadside with the Queen Anne's lace and the chicory and the
orange ones. And it's not flowers that she wants. She wants to keep them.
No, she doesn't.
She just wants to get rid of them.
Mm-hmm. Because she's going to do something else along that side where they are now, and so they seem to be really in there, and so I don't know. Maybe there's not even an answer for this one besides elbow grease.
Elbow grease, and short of, you know, and I'm not a real chemical person, but if someone were to use a Roundup or some sort of herbicide, it would take two applications because the daylilies will brown out, and then you'll get some regeneration, and they would have to be hit twice.
Oh, good, because she had mentioned Roundup, and I said, well, I know a lot of people are not fans of that, but aside from digging them, so two applications.
Mm-hmm.
Wait, put it on according to directions, and then wait for the browning to occur.
Well, right, and it's a little cool right now, and usually the effectiveness of something like Roundup is temperature dependent as well. So if you
get over 50 degrees at least,
right, over 50,
maybe by July.
Well, if she were to spray on a sunny day and then it's in the 70s, it's going to take probably 2 to 3 weeks to see them yellow and brown.
Oh, okay.
And then she has to wait another couple of weeks to see what little pups are going to come up and deal with those either manually or with herbicide. The hand digging, even if you have a crew of 12 people out there digging, you're going to get a regeneration. You'll have to do two or three digs. So the elbow grease can work on these. You know, they're called ditch lilies as well because they're so tough.
Oh, sure.
But it's a lot of digging, and you have to make sure you get all those roots.
Okay, so, well, I'll tell her what you suggested about the Roundup, and, so it's kind of a long process then, isn't it?
It is, and it's important to make sure they're entirely gone. Patience is important because no matter what you do, whether it's physical or chemical, it's one approach or one-time approach isn't gonna do it.
Oh, okay, well, that's really important information. And then if she follows through with the Roundup and she starts to see the browning and the yellowing, the shriveling, at that point she yanks them out? Is that just pull them up then? They'd be weak enough to do that?
Right, they'll actually turn extremely dry, and they can be even raked right off the top. But, again, in another 3 weeks you'll see some little green pieces coming up.
Yep.
And then that's the cue to reapply.
Correct.
Roundup, if that's the direction she goes. Or to start maybe digging. Maybe 50-50 Roundup for the first round and maybe digging for the second.
That could be an effective approach. It's just a matter of, every little piece of that root can regenerate. So, it's just, you have to be aggressive.
Yeah, I guess so. Well, thanks, Mark. I appreciate it.
Yeah,
and welcome.
Excellent show again, Larry.
Thank you, Sandy.
Take care now.
Yeah, you as well. Have a great day and have a great weekend. By the way, we have some more callers here. Eileen and Madison is up next, so let's go there. Hi, Eileen. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thank you. And I'll make this really quick. I heard about the buckthorn a couple of calls ago, and again the Roundup. You just had another question about Roundup. I have a home remedy that my daughter gave me of apple cider vinegar and table salt and Dawn detergent as a weed killer, and it's incredibly effective on weeds in the yard. But I wonder if that would be, if I did that on a buckthorn or on a woody stump of some kind, would that be as effective as a commercial herbicide?
You know, tough to say. It'd be great to do a side-by-side comparison. We've used apple cider vinegar in between brick cracks to eliminate weeds, and it's very effective.
Okay, just plain old vinegar?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just the vinegar without all the salt and the Dawn? Oh, okay.
Yep. That's worked fine. And now, buckthorn is such a tough beast. It'd be worth a try, but I worry that there would still be some suckering the next year.
Okay.
And, you know, I hope all Larry's listeners are limiting their chemical use, and I've talked a lot about specific chemicals in this show, but something like buckthorn to knock it down, you know, we're really globbing on with a paintbrush a good amount of heavily concentrated herbicide, and that's done it. And I'd love to think your recipe would work, and I think it's worth trying.
Okay. Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call.
Bye-bye.
Randy in Portage emailed to get suggestions for a quick growing plant that will serve as a privacy screen. 6 foot high would be great. Also, his neighbor has black walnuts. Would hemlock work?
Well, Canadian hemlock, the thing about Canadian hemlock, it would grow under walnuts, but hemlock needs a lot of moisture and really well-drained soils. And unfortunately, it's been relegated as a shade evergreen, and it really needs a little more sun and, again, a lot of dampness. So if the walnuts are creating an issue where there's a lot of root competition, without additional watering, the hemlocks will not thrive. Arborvitaes can grow under walnuts. If deer are an issue, you know, you don't want to go that route because they'll nibble on arborvitaes. A deciduous screen that grows very quickly, keeping in mind it's not much of a screen in winter, but privet. Grows 2-3 feet a year, and you can plant them very closely and get a very quick screen. A lot of different viburnums. If the intent is a 12-month of the year screen, an evergreen, again, you're leaning back on arborvitae. The hemlocks, again, with additional watering may work, but they're also extremely slow growing. It would never be a quick growing screen.
But they grow under walnut.
They can grow under walnut. We have one in our gazebo garden that's doing fairly decent. But there's an irrigation system, too, which helps keep it wet.
And Kathleen in Minnesota emailed to say how can she treat her blueberry for chlorosis? It's planted in large pots that are sunk into the ground.
Well, the chlorosis could be caused by a pH issue because blueberries need extremely low acidic pH. So my concern would be not so much addressing the yellowing of the leaves, but modifying the soil with muriacid or you need something to lower the pH in that soil, and I think that's what's happening.
And I think with the fact that they're in pots, this is much easier to control than would be normally the case. So I definitely would agree with you on that.
Mm-hmm.
I think it'd be a fairly easy or at least a quick remedy. Talking today with Mark Dwyer. Mark directs horticulture at the Rotary Botanical Gardens in Janesville. Our guest on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks so much for listening in here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Larry Mueller with my guest, Mark Dwyer, Director of Horticulture at Rotary Botanical Gardens in Janesville. Always great to have him along. Certainly, if you have a gardening question, I hope you will join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We were talking earlier about Kathleen, who wanted to know about treating her blueberries for chlorosis. And the blueberries are in large pots. She emailed back to ask what she can use to treat those blueberries, lime or bone meal, or what would she?
Right, I wouldn't use any of that. You certainly wouldn't want to use lime.
No,
excuse me.
That'd be the opposite.
That'd be the opposite. You want to get your pH down to about 4.5 or 5, ideally. What we've done for our acid-loving plants, and I know some people in containers growing blueberries have had success using slow-release sulfur and making sure that container soil has a lot of peat moss, because peat moss is slightly acidic. It's moisture retentive. When you think about where blueberries grow native further north in the state, we want to replicate those conditions. So look into slow-release sulfur and additional peat moss, and maybe even get a soil test from your container soil and see what sort of pH you end up with.
Very good points. Audrey in Kenosha, it's your turn. Hi, Audrey.
Thank you for taking my call. I have a question for you. I have purchased some elephant ears from a nursery, and they came in much smaller than what they were supposed to, and some of them are just, you know, they have roots on the bulb but no growth yet. What is the best way to jumpstart them? And the reason I'm asking is I just bought a heat mat this morning that I'm going. I was thinking about possibly putting them on, or could I make like get a grow bulb? And what is the best type of grow bulb that I could use to get those going, to get them, you know, mm-hmm. started?
Sure.
Right, great question. Timely, because just yesterday we had a lot of rain in Janesville, so we planted up our elephant ears yesterday, and we put them in a nice container with good soil, added fertilizer. We planted the bulb so the top of the bulb was only an inch below the soil level. Your heat mat will be excellent, because the trick now, keep in mind they won't need light for almost a month, because what's going to happen, you need as much heat as you can. And the radiant heat underneath from that heat mat is what's going to warm that soil up into the upper 70s and 80s, and that elephant ear is going to love it. But it's going to take a couple weeks for it to sprout. Now, you have the bulb, is that correct?
Well, I have bulbs, and I have plants that are about 4 inches tall.
Ah, okay. Well, then, yes, your need for light would be for those plants that have foliated already. Yeah, any sort of grow bulb would be fine. Keeping it just above the height of the leaves is prudent, simply so they won't stretch. And even on warm days, once we get into the 70s again or low 80s, get them outside for some fresh air.
Okay, yeah, because I have them in a south-facing window, which
okay.
gets plenty of sun during the daytime when it is sunny out.
Right.
But like I said, I just got these, and they're supposed to be 6 to 10 inches tall, and, you know, basically they're either the bulbs have not grown yet, or the plants are just about, you know, 3 to 4 inches tall.
Right. And, you know, don't be discouraged by that, because what you're seeing now, don't judge your plants yet, because what we need is a really hot summer.
Mm-hmm.
And we had an elephant ear collection last year with 80 varieties, and it was a cool summer, unfortunately. But those plants will catch up faster than you can imagine. But if you can provide that base heat now, that'll give them the jump. And they'll catch up. Don't worry about that.
Okay. All right.
Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call, Audrey.
Let me just one more quick question. If I would put like a little dome on them, like a grow dome, like when you get the seedlings and you put it into a germinator and you have that plastic lid on there, would that help also?
It wouldn't hurt. The added humidity is okay, but you want to make sure that soil in the pots, whatever the soil is, you want to make sure it's still well drained, but just keep it moist, because they're all moisture lovers.
Okay. All right.
All right.
Okay.
Thank you for calling. Connie in Portage, hello to you. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I just had something to add if you wanted a privacy fence. I planted bridal wreath, and it grew 6 foot high, and it's very close together, and the birds love it, and it's a great privacy fence. Just a suggestion for that person that called.
Yeah, bridal wreath's also fairly shade tolerant, if that's a consideration for the other caller. You know, keep in mind peak coloration is in spring, and it's an arcing shrub, so your placement, you need to make sure it's connecting. They tend to be a little open around the knees, so to speak, but to Connie's comment, they are excellent as a collective hedge and tough as nails.
All right, thank you very much for that. And Peter and Racine, thank you for calling.
Yeah, I want to be the ultimate hero about buckthorn. I found this out last December after cutting back buckthorn all year, all season long, till about late September. I just stopped doing it. This thing was starting to dry out already. So some grew maybe about 3 foot tall, the ones I didn't cut back again. And I know you're supposed to remove the root, but doing that, you know, you got to do a lot of digging. So, but anyway, here's these dried up plants. There's no leaves on anything. Like mid-December, it's already had a few freezes here in Racine. With snow on the ground, maybe some rain. So the ground's kind of soft and wet, but it's growing because it's still freezing every night. You know. So this is during the day, and it's thawed out, but it endured a few freezes. Anyway, I grabbed this buckthorn. Let's see if I could, you know, rip it up. And just pulled up like a carrot out of soft soil. I tried another one, same thing. It's so easy getting rid of them in the winter then.
Maybe some of the smaller ones might come up that way. I should mention there's actually a tool called a root jack that allows you to get up to, I think, inch and a half diameter, any type of woody plant. and it's sort of a lever. There's a lot of physics to it, but we've used that on smaller buckthorns late in the season, similar to what Peter's talking about, and they've come out. I've never tried to dig them that late in the season. We'll give it a whirl, but my concern is about those that are 3 to 4 to 9 inches in diameter, these massive beasts. A little more elbow grease with those.
Yeah, for sure. Peter, thanks for calling. I want to give George and Oshkosh a chance to join in. George, hi.
Hello. I have another buckthorn issue with that. The salt and vinegar and soap will not be systemic and will not go into the root. Mm-hmm. Even if you use it on something like wild parsnip, it'll either right away reef sprout from the roots or, again, come in the next year as it's a biennial. So the salt will not work on the buckthorn.
All right. There we go. Thanks, George.
Good to know. Yeah.
Good to know. And Chris in Heartland. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Mark. Thank you for answering. We have trilliums growing on the north side of our garage, kind of have a Door County garden. We have whites, reds, yellows, and a lot of Jack in the Pulpits. We started with, I think, one red and maybe 3 whites, and now we've got maybe 100 reds, a bunch of them. What I need to know is, what are the proper soil conditions? What nutrients should I add? The area we put them in had arborvitas, so there was a lot of wood chip left. And it was right up against the garage, which had traffic bond, which is crushed lime. And I've added pelletized lime, but the whites are starting to wane. The reds and the Jack in the Pulpits and the yellows are doing just great.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, let me insert envy, first of all, because trilliums can be tricky, and it sounds like you haven't had much trouble establishing them. But they do differ based on the species and their needs. And, you know, if you can track down the specific species, actually doing a little research and trying to replicate their native conditions, which typically are moist woodlands, very humus-rich soil, well-drained, but that's not universal for all plants and certainly not for all trilliums. But it sounds like with your approach with the whites having issues, my guess is that's a pH thing right now.
Right.
So I think getting having a lower pH is going to be ideal. And I wonder if our previous conversations about peat moss and slow-release sulfur may lower that pH to a point where the whites are thriving.
Okay, and I just added to that portion of the garden.
Right, right. And there's some great books out on trilliums that may have a little more information on your specifics. But, again, well done, because that's we've been having a hard time with trilliums, and once they get going, though, there's nothing more beautiful, that's for sure.
These are native. My mother-in-law had a home in Waukesha County, actually in Waukesha City, and had trilliums grow naturally there. And we got the reds and whites from her and the yellow from a mail-order catalog. And we got the Jack in the Pulpits from a dear friend who just passed away.
Oh, well, wonderful.
But we have hundreds of them.
A wonderful collection, absolutely.
Yeah, wonderful.
So, okay, I will look that up. And do you have a number for pH that I should shoot for?
I think typically you're looking for between 5 and 6 if you can reach it is ideal.
Yeah. It's a reach, 5 in particular.
Okay, for the whites.
Correct.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep.
All right, well, thank you very much.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. Yeah, and open lines again. We can get you on pretty quickly at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. Carol posted on Facebook that she has a 4x8 raised bed for a child's garden. What plants do you suggest as best for kids?
Well, I'd like to compliment Carol on the dimensions, because that's a great size. The 4-foot width allows anyone to reach from the edges and not have to climb in there too much. You know, in terms of plants, I think going back to edibles, I think are rewarding, but also consider the value of that sensory experience. Having fragrant plants, herbs, consider tactile plants, those with fuzzy leaves. Mm-hmm. I'm happy both my daughters are gardeners, and my younger one fell into it by her love of just touching lamb's ears at a very young age. So perhaps the child could have some input in the types of plants they want to grow. Some pointed questions about, hey, would you like to grow some your own food or some spices, or should we get some butterflies in here? And that'll dictate your plant selection. But having that dimensional raised bed is excellent, and then you're in control of the soil and can grow you know, sky's the limit with what you can do.
Yeah, absolutely. Good post. Thanks, Carol. We had Rebecca wanting to know from Facebook, what's the best way to start hollyhock seeds?
Well, hollyhock seeds, old-fashioned hollyhocks are biennials. You know, it takes 2 years from seed to bloom. Most of the modern hollyhocks will bloom the first year. So, in essence, hollyhock seeds, you can start, they should have been started already if you're going to be planting them out in the next month or so. That's not to say they couldn't be started now, but what you'll be doing is planting them later in the season. And hollyhocks will typically overwinter after a late sowing and late planting and bloom the next year. It really depends on what variety she's selecting, but hollyhocks are extremely easy to grow from seed. I just personally would have started it about 4 weeks ago.
Sue posted on Facebook, she has a couple of autumn blaze maples. She's heard that they are prone to splitting, which I guess they are, and she has trimmed them to have a main leader on one, which is working, but the other has several leaders. The trimming isn't working very well, I guess. How should she handle that, and how long does she continue to prune?
Well, you know, I think autumn blaze maples, they're a hybrid. They're a hybrid between silver maple and red maple.
Yeah.
So nice fall color, but some little bit of soft wood. So there is some splitting with some of the more upright varieties, but the upright varieties have very similar codominant leaders. There's usually a point to them, but I guess my confusion is if there's a lot of stems that are reaching the same height and it looks like it's sort of flat-topped, then you start considering removing some of those. But if it still has a roughly pointed shape, I wouldn't worry about it because they're going to constantly be sending out these upright branches. So I wouldn't worry so much about the pruning. Autumn blaze maples will round out with age, and I feel they're fairly tough. So again, I wouldn't worry so much about splitting with that specific variety. I would take a photo or get a certified arborist on site to take a look at it and recommend a course of pruning because it's tough to do it just based on the comment, to be honest.
Mary wonders, Mary Kay wonders, how do you get rid of snow on the mountain? She's tried vinegar and Roundup. I can't imagine Roundup didn't do it.
Well, kind of like the daylily conversation, that snow on the mountain is about three applications of Roundup, and then the next spring you hit the rest of the sprigs with the fourth. It is a thug, and it wants to survive, so one application won't do it.
Chris in Viroqua, hello.
Yes, hello.
What can we do for you?
Yeah, I got a suggestion, you know, getting back to the buckthorn conversation. I work in the land management industry, and my fiance works in the organic farming industry, and so sometimes we're at odds with, you know, trying to use herbicides on woody materials. And we have buckthorn at our house, and we're actually using a smothering mechanism where, you know, there is a product called the buckthorn baggie, but it's, you know, basically using a very, very thick, you know, black plastic bag and cutting the buckthorn about 6 inches high and then securing, you know, that baggie or that really thick plastic material about 3 inches up, and then, you know, having enough material so it fans out over the top of that. And in effect, it's, you know, smothering the plant, and, you know, it's going to take a year to kill them off, but in a small application in our backyard and close to our garden space, I think it's going to work pretty well, because, you know, like you talked about, like the vinegar, that it'll top kill things, but it won't really kill the root of things. So, just wanted to put that out there as another
way
I think would work well.
Ah, Chris, thanks very much for calling. Haven't tried that, but
no, I'd sleep better at night if I think we'd try something like that because I would sleep better at night knowing we're not applying all those chemicals. That'd be great to try.
Give that a shot. Thanks again, Chris. Bob in Arborvita, hello.
Good morning, Larry. I'm going to be in the minority today, not going to ask you about buckthorn. I got a question about growing grass in northern Wisconsin in Arborvita. Got a lot of pine trees, and I have a problem with quite a bit of moss that's growing on the ground. I'm trying to get rid of the moss and grow some grass.
Yeah, the trick with moss, and, you know, we're Rotary Gardens, we have a moss garden. We're encouraging moss in a certain area, and Wisconsin actually has 400 different types of moss, and they're beautiful in their own right, but I understand many gardeners try to eliminate it. It's important to address the site simply because moss doesn't displace grass. Moss is simply growing there because it's more advantageous to grow moss than grass. So I don't know if there's a way to open up more light or do something with that soil that would, again, be more appropriate for establishing turf versus moss. So they're not competitors at all.
You know, I'm surrounded by like 80 to 100-foot white and red pine trees. It's, you know, it's right on the lake side of the house. It gets a lot of shade. I'm wondering if there's a pH component here that maybe I need to address.
That could be. However, mosses don't have true roots, so pH is a very small consideration for mosses. They're a very primitive plant. The pH, though, may be a factor on why the grass isn't thriving, so a soil test might be in order. With all those pines, my guess is your soil is fairly acidic. But
And you've got a lot of shade, and you probably have some damper soil.
And so the higher the pH, the more acidic, is that correct?
No, the reverse of that.
Reverse.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I want to. I'm striving then for a lower pH. Is that correct?
Well, my guess is your pH. You know, a soil test would prove this, but my guess is you're under neutral, which is 7, just because of all your pine trees. But turf can be grown successfully in both alkaline and acidic soils, just not the extremes. So I guess I would start with a soil test, but also, again, really examine the lighting that's happening there and see if there's something that could be modified.
My guess is that there's not enough light, and that leads to sort of damper conditions, and that's pretty much what moss mm-hmm. likes.
Right.
So you got a problem there, Bob, that I'm not quite sure. Short of clearing out some area and getting more sunlight in there. If you're going to have a lot of success. Chuck, in Wisconsin Dells, hi.
Hi, thank you. Say, I'm wondering, I've got a kind of a lilac hedge out here, and it's getting pretty tall. I wonder, what's the odds of getting it cut down to 3 or 4 feet and still having a hedge there for lilacs?
Okay.
Well, it can be done. Lilacs can respond to severe pruning. Of course, the best time to prune them is after they're done flowering. But I've seen larger French lilacs, those that get into that 10 to 15 to 20-foot range, being severely cut back. Although what I'd recommend is not stubbing it off at 2 or 3 feet, but taking those really large stems down. And whether you do that after it's done flowering or you do it very late in the season, the response will be fairly immediate with new growth. But maintaining a lilac hedge at a shorter height is a little challenging unless you select shorter varieties.
Yeah,
well, I know they're pretty hard to kill.
Right.
You cut the biggest, like what is it, usually thirds we think of, but
right.
the top, the tallest third, cut them right down to the ground.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Gotcha.
And
Thank you.
Thanks a lot, because you're going to get a lot better growth and a lot better flowering, as a matter of fact. And we've got some events coming up again. I wanted to talk, Mark, about the Rotary Gardens in Janeville plant sale coming up.
Right, Mother's Day weekend, and that's May 7th and 8th, 9 a.m. till 4 p.m. at Rotary Gardens. Check our website out for details, and that's www.rotarybotanicalgardens.org. And there's some plant lists on our website, but lots of veggies, herbs, perennials, shrubs, compost, lots of things happening.
And a lot of heirloom vegetables, right?
Many heirloom selections, particularly of tomatoes.
So that's going to be a lot of fun. And again, we have, I believe, Jill's got a link up on our Facebook page to the Rotary Gardens. But again, it's Rotary Botanical Gardens. That's all one word, Rotary Botanical Gardens. .org.
Yes.
Mark, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Larry.
Mark Dwyer directs horticulture at the Rotary Botanical Gardens, degrees in landscape architecture and urban forestry. And, of course, he knows a whole lot about a lot of different plants and a lot of cool things going on at the gardens. And I really would encourage you to take a look online to see, because there's some wonderful photos, and you'll get an idea of what the gardens are like, and it's really fun to have a chance to visit them. I haven't. I've really enjoyed it. So next week on Garden Talk, we'll be talking with a couple of people from the UW-Madison Arboretum. And then on Monday, we'll talk personal computers and answer your personal computer questions. Have a great weekend. Thanks for listening. Stay with us.